This is Radio Skid Row On Demand.
We have with us the Mayor of Marrickville, Joe Halen.
Welcome to the program, Mr. Manu Tauri. Kia ora, morena Manu.
The CEO, Make-A-Wish, Gerard Menzies.
Radio Skid Row On Demand.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Jeff Furillo and you're listening to the Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century on Radio Skid Row 88.9 FM. The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century is a weekly program for older Australians where we talk about ageing well. And every week, we'll talk about the issues that affect us as we age, right here and right now.
It happens every day.
Later in today's episode, we will be talking with Graham Bond of Auntie Jack fame about the formative cultural experiences in a segment called Nostalgia Town. Nostalgia Town is a weekly segment where we hear a well-known older Australian talk about their formative cultural experiences. In later episodes, we'll hear from SBS newsreader Anton Enos, who shares his experiences of growing up in South Africa, as well as his recent success in beating bowel cancer. Australian comedian and author Jean Kitson speaks with us, and Radio Skid Row's own elder, Lex Marinos, who everybody remembers as Bruno from Kingswood Country and the early days of ABC's 2JJ. And after that, we'll be speaking with the NOS Council's Joint Senior Citizen of the Year, June Stoddart, about her life and involvement as a volunteer with the Asylum Seeker Centre in Newtown. But first things first, today we are going to discuss the importance of social connections as we age with an expert and then my two studio guests who will chew the fat with me on the Punters panel. Our expert guest today is Professor Catherine Haslam, Professor at the School of Psychology at the Faculty of Health and Behavioural Sciences at the University of Queensland. Catherine has been involved in international research investigating the link between belonging to social identity groups and well-being as we age. I began by asking Professor Haslam, how much difference does it make to belong to social identity groups as we age? And in what ways is it good for us?
Increasingly, what we're seeing with research, that research is showing that our relationships with social groups that we value make a huge impact on our health and well-being. Now, these groups can be our family groups, friendship, neighbourhood, religious groups, work groups, sporting groups, and any other groups. And what we find is that people who are more socially connected, they're healthier, they're happier, and they also live longer. For example, from an influential study that's combined findings from about 140 different studies, that social connectedness affects our life expectancy. And the authors of that study concluded that people with good social relationships had a 50% greater likelihood of survival than those with weaker relationships. Now, another study that we've been involved in that's involving retirees found that with every social group that you lose after retirement, your life expectancy reduces by about 3% and your quality of life declines by 10%. But in the context of thinking about aging too, there's also some interesting data on cognitive or brain health. So in a population-based study that we've run involving people who were over 50 years of age, we found that those people who were more active in more social groups perform better on tests of cognitive ability, things like attention, concentration and memory. And here we found that people aged 50 or more, with 50 who had more social group ties, performed more like 46-year-olds. And those who were aged 80 with more social group ties were performing more like 70-year-olds. So what that's kind of telling us is that the impact of our social relationships are even more important on our health as we age. We also see that there's actually these benefits on mental health too. So a study led by a colleague of ours, Tegan Cruis, found that if you're over 50 and you join a social group, then you cut your risk of developing depression by about 24%. So what you can see here is that these aren't trivial effects, and they show that our social relationships are a pretty key ingredient in keeping us healthy across a range of different health outcomes.
That's very encouraging. I guess that it means that as well as improving our lives by looking after our diet and our physical health and making sure that we exercise, making sure that we belong to groups of people is important for our health as well.
Yeah, no, and that's definitely true. And I think that a lot of what happens is that we're prioritising those other aspects, which, don't get me wrong, they're really important too. But we should be balancing that with actually addressing our social connectedness as well, as you say.
Social connectedness. Let's talk a little bit about social connectedness. You mentioned family, church groups, other things like that. Is going out for a ride with my mates on a Saturday part of this kind of social identity group?
It can be that. It can be you and your fellow book club members getting together who love reading, or a group of people who really enjoy theatre or films getting together. So, yeah, it can be as simple as that. But the important thing there is that it's the groups that share with people that share a common interest with you that's really important here. Basically, getting together as that collective, people who share common interests.
And not just one-off contact, but continuing over time.
Generally, it is over time. There's interesting work that's actually been done by some colleagues of ours in the UK, who've actually shown that sometimes you can actually develop that strong sense of connectedness very quickly. So, for instance, if you think some of the work that they'd actually conducted was with the London bombings, and what they actually found was that some of the people who were involved in those London bombings, who were actually experiencing a common fate, actually worked collectively and joined together very well and worked effectively very well. So you can see that there are some situations and contexts where it might take a little bit of time to develop that sort of strong sense of connectedness and bonds, but there are also other circumstances where it can develop pretty quickly.
Well, it's quite clear that there's a benefit in belonging to social groups, social identity groups, but why do we see these benefits?
Mm-hmm. Now, our social groups, when they're positive, can provide us with a range of resources. They're a really important source of support. So we hear about social support a lot. And they're a source of support when we're stressed or vulnerable. Now, we know from research that stress, particularly when it's something that's ongoing and has an ongoing effect on our lives, that it can have damaging effects on our body, putting pressure on our immune system and putting pressure on other systems. So our social groups are a source of protection that have been shown to reduce the stress response associated with the wear and tear in our bodies. But groups also give us a range of other resources too. They can boost our sense of self-worth and self-esteem. They provide us with a sense of belonging, so we're part of something bigger. They give our lives meaning. They give us a sense of purpose. They also help us feel much more in control of our lives. So contrary to what we usually believe as social relationships being fairly abstract, our social relationships give us these things that are pretty tangible. So it's a way, you know, we need to start thinking about, you know, social relationships as being a source of resource, tangible resources, that we should be thinking about harnessing when we're trying to protect our health.
So what are the steps we can take to join new groups as we age?
Now, what we know is that our groups tend to work best when they're ones that we identify with. So they become an important part of who we are. So think about that like our groups being an extension of ourselves. So as I said earlier on, for some people, reading is an important part of their identity, and joining a book club is a good way of living that part out of you out. The same goes for those who love talking about politics, walking, bowling, volunteering, and so on. So the recommendation here is to think about what's important to you and to join groups where you can engage in those interests with other people who share those interests, so you have that kind of common bond.
And I guess we see that kind of thing going on in places like men's sheds.
Yeah, absolutely. So men's shed is a nice example. And also increasingly what we're seeing is that, you know, in the context of men and groups, there's certainly evidence that women tend to be a little bit more groupy than men. But I think that's part and parcel of having the appropriate groups for men to actually connect to. So So groups are only going to have are only going to be meaningful to people if they make sense for them to be part of those groups, and that they meet their interests.
And because men seem to be less groupy than women, are they more at risk of some bad outcomes?
Look, I think that anybody who doesn't sort of engage in those groups is at risk. But as you say, as a population, what we generally find is that women tend to be more strongly connected and work with those connections more easily. So, yeah, this is, you know, men might be more of an at-risk group and one that we need to actually invest in and make sure that that there are opportunities for them to connect and bond with others.
And what if you belong to no social groups, or if you're shy or you're anxious, or if you have poor social skills?
Yeah, now that's an interesting point there, because the evidence actually shows that social skills training is among the least effective ways of dealing with social isolation. So what that tells me is that it's not just about those social skills. Social skills are important to some extent, but they're not the whole story. I think, as you say, it's certainly hard to connect and particularly challenging for people who feel shy and anxious, because groups can take you out of your comfort zone. But I think that there are a couple of things to think about in terms of trying to deal with this. First of all, making the decision that you need to extend your networks in some way is a really important first step. But remember, you don't have to do that by yourself. You don't have to do it alone. Take a friend who might have similar interests, or look to groups where you know someone who's part of that group. This can kind of make joining a little bit easier. As I kind of alluded to early in response to some of your earlier questions, I think it's important too for people to take some time to think about the groups they want to join, so they're a good fit with you and your interests. So if you're part of a group that includes people who have similar interests to you, then it's easier to start and continue conversations. But I'd also suggest taking a little bit of time to plan how you'd go about extending your group ties and thinking about the steps you would take to do this. Exploring what groups actually exist there in the community, when they meet, how you would make time to meet up with them, and so on. So a little planning goes a long way. Finally, it's also the case that it becomes easier to extend your networks after you just join one or two. So just joining that one or two just gives you a little bit of that scaffold and a little bit of that experience to make it easier to make the next step and join another.
So get connected and stay connected.
Yeah, that's the point.
I'm Peter Arndt, and I'm a social commentator mainly on gender issues. You're listening to The Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century. Get connected and stay connected.
We are speaking with Professor Catherine Haslam from the University of Queensland School of Psychology, and she's talking to us today about the link between social identity groups and well-being as we age. I asked Catherine Haslam, who of us has the most difficulty adapting to change as we age?
Look, part of adapting to life changes, say when we retire, or when we move even, is that some of the old networks and the identities that we have and that we value are hard to maintain. And this can really affect us deeply when those groups are an important part of who we are in our lives. Now, what our studies show is that when people experience these sorts of life changes, it's important to make sure that we maintain at least some of our old ties where we can and where we want to, but also to develop some new ones to counter any loss of groups that we might experience because of the change. In this kind of research, we've also found that those who haven't felt strongly connected to groups prior to a life change might find this the hardest. People who are already strongly connected and belong to multiple social groups actually find it easier to make new ones. So it's definitely worth investing some effort into joining new groups in ways we've just talked about, as connecting with one or two groups when you aren't really strongly connected definitely helps you to scaffold development of those groups more. To help along the way, many charities and communities have a range of activities and arts-based groups on offer as part of what we're now starting to hear about as social prescribing. Now, social prescribing is an approach where people, through their GPs and other community services, are supported by a caseworker to help them talk through what social groups are on offer and what they might join in their local community. Now, that's pretty well established in the UK and it's being more embedded there, but it's not as well established here in Australia as a process. But there is growing interest in introducing such social programs here. Despite that, I think that there are still some people who struggle because they might have long-term social isolation, they might have major health problems or experience major unexpected life changes that, you know, really change their lives dramatically. And in these sorts of, in this particular context, we've actually developed a new program, Groups for Health, that actually tackles this issue of helping people to connect with their groups. Retirement is a really important transition. There are other life transitions that people experience, but it's one of those major ones. Even though we prepare for this, particularly we engage in a lot of financial planning for this, what we find is that the people who aren't actually attending and thinking about sort of maintaining the social connections that they can and building new ones, they're the ones who have lower life expectancy. They're also the ones who experience reduced quality of life. So attending to a bit of this social planning is really important, and as important as engaging in the financial planning. So let me tell you just a little bit about Groups for Health first. So it's a program that we actually developed after running a whole load of studies that we conducted that were a little bit more along the lines of those social prescribing activities, things like, you know, we had men's clubs, we ran water clubs to combat dehydration, we ran reminiscence groups and so on. But one of the things that we actually wanted to do was to, you know, was to develop a program that gave agency to people so they could actually understand what was best for their group life and put them in control of that. So Groups for Health is actually a program that aims to give people the knowledge and the skills that they need to join and strengthen their social group-based relationships in ways that protect their health. Now, there's quite a lot of programs out there that already deal with the more intimate one-on-one relationships that we have with significant other individuals. And this is clearly important, but so are our group-based relationships because they're as important in our lives and they do a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to protecting health. So our program helps people to recognise which groups have a positive influence on health and those that might sometimes be harmful and to recognise that. We engage people in a range of exercises and discussions to understand what their current social group worlds look like, and we use that as a basis for helping people to identify groups that they might want to join, that they might want to extend on or strengthen and harness further to support their health. And we also use it to identify gaps in people's social group worlds that they might want to work on. And through the program, we also work with people on strategies to achieve their outcomes, including development of structured social plans for people that they can trial. And we can troubleshoot challenges during that trial that people might actually experience. So we've tested this program out, and we found that in addition to increasing people's sense of connectedness to their groups, it helps reduce loneliness, it helps reduce depression, and it helps reduce anxiety. Now, right now, we don't have a program like this in Sydney, and that's largely due to our resourcing. But we're hoping to be able to introduce this as we develop partnerships with various health and community services that we can work with in order to try and develop some of these sorts of programs in the Sydney Basin. We're talking to a variety of community services, but also with various hospital services as well and primary health networks to engage in this discussion to see whether we can actually provide this as a resource for people in communities.
I guess this might be a little bit encouraging. One of the questions I like to ask people is, can ageing be fun?
Yeah. Well, I think the answer to that is absolutely. And I think it's absolutely, particularly when people are in a place to make the most of the time that they have as they age. And social groups, when they're a positive influence on our lives, are a key factor in making our lives fun. We're at heart social beings. And our social relationships are what, for many people, makes life worth living. So I think you're undermining your capacity to make ageing fun if you take social groups out of the equation and don't harness them to best effect.
Catherine Haslam, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on Baby Boomer's Guide to Life in the 21st Century.
Thanks very much for giving me some time on the program.
Radio Skid Row, 88.9 FM.
Radio Skid Row is a listener-supported station. Through a lot of commitment and hard work, Radio Skid Row has survived over 30 years. And one way you can help us to continue to grow is by becoming a supporter. It won't cost you much and it's easy. Go to radioskidrow.org and click the support tab. If you'd prefer to use an online bank transfer to donate, contact us directly by email, info@skidrow.com.au, or phone us on 02-9560-4254 for more information.
Support the station that supports you. Radio Skid Row.
88.9 FM.
And now it's time for the Punters Panel, where we speak with local older people about the issue of the day. And today in the studio, on the Punters Panel, our studio guests are Lorne Hyde, who is aged somewhere between 55 and 80 and lives locally. Lorne works as a nurse in the local health district and he's transitioning to retirement. And also we have our very own Caroline Pryor, the presenter of Radio Skid Row's Workers Radio every Friday on Radio Skid Row from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. Now, we've just listened to Professor Haslam talking about the importance of social identity groups as we transition in ageing. And she's given us a lot of ideas about why it's important. But the question, I suppose, Lorne, is how do we make it work?
Jeff, I think that's a great question. And listening to what she was saying, we all know about the research. We all know about the benefits of, connectedness in our community. But I always questioned, that's great to have all that research, but what do we do to make it work at a local level? And I always think about having something start locally, go globally, you know, make it grow. But that's always a difficult question.
Well, I always like the idea of councils, and that's why, of course, we in the Inner West are pretty lucky, is that there does seem to be a whole variety of things. Now, I have transitioned, so I am retired, and I don't know, I feel that there is a range of things. Because I've been in the same area, I've got the same kind of friends in the same area. So the change from work, where I lost a whole lot of work friends, is now changed into things. And I've found that my hobbies that I could get to, you know, once a month, now are becoming much more interesting. And so the idea that when you actually change, when you transition, the idea that doors are opening and windows are closing, or is that the other way around? Yeah. One of those things, because you get confused when you're retired. But that whole idea of social groups. But what I really wanted to talk about with Professor Haslam is the ones that are good for you. If you've got toxic family, if those children never leave home and they're just driving you nuts, and the only thing you want to do is go down the pub and meet up for a sundowners, then, you know, is that a good social group, or is that going to have positive, harmful effects? All those kinds of issues. I think there's lots of social groups where, you know, people are really nutty.
Well, it's interesting because at my local pub, there's a lot of older people.
Oh!
Yeah. And I go there after having listened to this, and I think, gee, this is social connectedness for those guys. And they may get inebriated and stumble home, but there's 4 or 5 hours of their day when they actually get out of the house. And some of these people are very old, so that's their social activity for the day. It might not be a healthy one in the terms of health outcomes, but it certainly is a good social one. And
but I don't think Professor Haslam is like wanting old people to get pissed and stagger off home.
Well, I don't know. She did say that your local friends are a good thing. You live longer if you have a social connectedness. And some of these guys seem to prove the point. You know, they're in their 70s and 80s and older. So,
Well, do they actually find out a lot? I know my father learned how to work a microwave at the pub, and so because all these things. When my mother died, but there's a whole range of vulnerable and stressy things which I don't know that pubs the great.
They've learned to use the ATM, I noticed. That's a helpful thing. Get your money out. But taking your point about having transitioned to retirement and using the local resources and council, you're an intelligent woman who's been local in the community. I work in a very diverse community with people who doesn't speak the language very well. Where I live, there's lots of Macedonians and Greek who still speak their own language,
yes,
and who are very isolated. And how do we make them a part of our connected community? How do we make them a part of our technology, a part of our society? And I see...
Well, do they want to? The argument is that connection, and I've got a lot of friends, and their aged parents, and, of course, the local... Because the local church as well, and they're saying all the old people are still here, or the new families have moved away, but of course when they all come together for family, then it's really important that the old people are here. But they're not talking, the older people older than me are not talking English, they've never talked English. There's a Greek radio, for heaven's sake.
That's right.
So the idea is there are parallels, there are levels of different societies who are all doing the same thing. But, I mean, they're all at the seniors trying to get online. I think they're all on Facebook and they're all reading, learning how to read Greek papers online, Spanish papers online, Portuguese papers online.
Well, that's assuming that they're actually... internet savvy, and I would say that the majority of people that I know are not like that. And we often make the statement, well, you know, they don't want to do it, but you often don't know that you don't want to unless you know what's available and you've participated.
But I reckon it's a class thing. Sorry to bring in Workers' Radio, but it's who's got the money, and that percentage, it's like about 25% of the community, and I'd say a lot of them are old, but a lot of them are poor or have got issues. But, I mean, they can't get online. And if you can't get online, if your library, that's what grandchildren are for, is to get you online, to get your Facebook up, and to work out where the newspapers are and to do that, then... You've got to have a whole range of connections, families, friends, location.
But oftentimes in today's society we have elderly parents who we don't live near, we don't have time to deal with. And as Jeff said, well, how do you make this work? And when we ask ourselves that question, I think we ask, how do we make this work for everybody in our society? The weakest link, if they can't work with what we think is going to improve their health, then we really are not very successful in achieving that outcome of good health and connectedness in our community.
I think that retirement couple of years before and after, that idea of transitioning is really problematic. Mm-hmm. And of course for people who are tired, who are not well, then I think it doubles and triples being as harder.
Now, do you two believe, as some do, including Hugh McKay, that there is an epidemic of loneliness going on in Australia at the moment?
That's a trick question, I think. Loneliness. I think there's a lot of people who are alone. I mean, the demographics of people who are living by themselves is burgeoning, and will do. But I think a lot of people are really tired of, especially in the inner west, dealing with a vibrant and dynamic and confrontational kind of city. So the idea is that they go home and hide, and they have that peace and lock out the things that they can't deal with until they gird their loins for the next day.
Well, I agree with him. I think that isolation and loneliness is a very predominant in our community. I think, we often read about people dying in their house and you haven't found them for weeks on end. We don't have any connection like Neighbourhood Watch. We don't have a sense of community anymore. Everybody's on the bustle. Everybody's working. You get lonely people in houses by themselves, empty nest syndrome, and they're just left there. And I've often thought, getting back to the question of how do we make this work, I've often thought about why can't we have a type of neighbourhood watch where you would have one person in every street keeping an eye out, and you get to know all your neighbours. I mean, I come from a very small community, and I always want to go back to that. I had that sense of belonging, and in my old age, I would be looked after. My neighbour would know they hadn't seen me for 2 days. They'd knock on the door. They'd see if I was sick. They put a note under my door. I'd put a note under the door, say, ring me by tomorrow, I'm coming in. You know, there's ways of doing this.
Now, I understand that in France, and I've read this somewhere, so it may be true, it may not be true, that the lollipop person is actually one of the keys in the community. The lollipop person is the one who sees people, in particular older people, as they go about their usual day. And the lollipop person might be the first person who can tell that somebody hasn't come out today.
Well, you mean the school traffic lollipop person?
Yes, I do.
No, I mean, we're mature. We've paid our taxes. I don't want anybody infringing my lives and knocking about. The thing is, if people make a choice, then I think that's fine, and I think we've got to do it. How do you encourage people who are reluctant, who have lost close family, who are making difficult transitions? How do you encourage them? How do you welcome them into community environments?
And the hardest one is the first one. If you've become lonely and isolated over time, if you've lost your partner, you've lost your networks, then moving on to that first next opportunity is the hardest one.
Well, the technology's there, though. Everybody's Facebooking. A lot of people I know from other countries are in tune with all their people. They're not having a local situation. They've got an online one. Isn't that enough?
Well, Carol, I would like to see the statistics about people over the age of 70, say, that are actually online, that are actually engaged in the online community, aside from the fact that it might be that you can Skype your family or, you know, get on Facebook. But if you join a social Facebook group, for example, I used to moderate one of the largest ones in Marrickville, and the amount of bullying that goes on there, people then withdraw because they're so frightened, and they're so frightened that somebody might come and get them or that they can't say anything without being attacked. So,
oh, gosh. No, I was talking about people keeping in contact with their family that is spread around the country, if not around the world.
So
I didn't know you had. Well, that's it. You don't want to be organising bullying.
No, but the other thing is that I wouldn't consider that being a part of the social connectedness in society.
Ah.
I would see that we need to have them involved in the community as opposed to families only.
Physically.
Yeah. Mm.
Okay, well, look, I want to thank you both very much. My members of the Punters panel, Caroline Pryor and Lorne Hyde, talking to us today about connectedness and the importance of social identity networks as you age. And now for the segment of the show that we call Nostalgia Town, where we talk to well-known older Australians about the musical, the theatrical and the film experiences that helped make them the people they are today.
You must remember this, a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh.
My guest today is Graham Bond, AM. Graham is an Australian actor, writer, director, musician and composer, known primarily for his role as Auntie Jack. We're speaking today on the segment of the show called Nostalgia Town. And I think it's fair to say, Graham Bond, that you're an icon of Australian iconoclasm.
You can say that, I can't.
Well, I can, because you're a big part of my upbringing. But we're here today to talk about your cultural formation. What were the important things to you as you were growing up?
I was born 1943, that chaotic period when the world didn't know what was happening to it. You know, Sydney was being bombed by the Japanese, Darwin was being bombed, and my parents decided to have a baby. I was brought up on radio. I mean, radio was a major, major part of my life. Radio and one other thing. My parents were working class. They were blue collar. Dad was a storm and packer, and my mother worked in the post office. Of course, they didn't take me to the classics to see Shakespeare or theatre. They took me to the Tivoli to see vaudeville. Oh. I used to go along with my best mate, and they used to take us. We'd sit in the gods, and we'd be the old Tivoli down the Central Railway Station. I went there especially to see the fabulous George Wallace. George Wallace was from Great Britain, and he had come from there as a child, and he was a wonderful visual comic. He was a great dancer, silly, very silly. He used to do fabulous tap routines where he could actually take his feet from under himself and land flat in his face on stage and break the audience up. Well, of course, sitting in the gods, all you could really see was the top of his head. You couldn't really actually, because you were so far up, you had to almost take oxygen at the Tivoli. He was just my absolute hero, and I always remembered him, and I wrote about him in my book, about how he made a fabulous entrance. They'd say, and now it's time for George Wallace, a little fat man with his hat turned up at the front and a really baggy suit, and he'd come running in from side stage, and as he got towards the microphone, he'd trip and slide on his shoulder and his ear with his legs in the air until he got to the middle of the stage and he'd crumple into a heap and then stand up and say, I don't know why I did that. He went on to make films with the great Ken Hall, and he made Where's George and a whole lot of early films in the 50s and 60s. Well, as I said to you, radio is incredibly important in my life because we had one of those giant old-style radios, and Mum and Dad used to listen to their stuff at night, but I could listen to what I liked. There were comedy shows. There was a show called Yes What, which was a bit goonish, but Australian, about school teachers and about school. And the other thing that I loved was Australian. There was a show called The Bonington's Bunkhouse with George Foster, and that was recorded at the Phillip Street Theatre in Macquarie Street when it was down that way. And I went along and saw a couple. Mum and Dad used to take me in. Now, the Goons, everyone says, oh, were you influenced by the Goons? And I went, no, not really, because Mum and Dad didn't listen to the ABC. The ABC didn't have the blue-collar workers. They just didn't. I'll tell you why. The ABC was more English than the BBC. To read the news on the ABC, you'd hear them. They'd say, good evening, this is the ABC. It was terribly, terribly British. Of course, to Mum and Dad, they were from the country, basically. Dad used to say, Graham, come over here. Fantastic.
Well, you've got to be able to hear your own voice on the radio.
Got to hear your own voice. And when I did Auntie Jack, I thought, bugger you. Here we go. Cop this. Mavis Bamston was fantastic. But Gordon Chater was English. Carol Ray, who was in the show, was English. And Barry Crocker wasn't English, but he tried to be English. And there were English scripts, and they had very few Australians writing for it. And so when I got the chance at the ABC, I went, bugger it. Here we go. Cop this. But on top of all that, they were my favourite shows. And then, of course, we had all the serials. Like, there was Superman, and there was Captain Fortune and the Sea Hound, which Leonard Teal did all the voices for.
Good evening. Leonard Teal used to do, you know, the channels of coolness, the echoes are calling it down the dim gorges, I hear the creek falling. The Cult from Snowy River. And all of those things were a mishmash of things that influenced me through that. And also in that period, my best friend, Gary Lewis, who lived down the hill from me in Marrickville, he got the first reel-to-reel tape recorder in our area, and he was my best mate. So we used to make our own radio shows. We used to do our own comedy shows, and we'd record for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
So it all started right here in Marrickville?
All right here in Marrickville. So I was in 331 Livingston Road, Marrickville, and he was in 516 Illawarra Road, Marrickville. In those days, 516 Illawarra Road, Marrickville, was directly opposite an open garbage tip. Steel Park was an open garbage tip, and Gary and I used to go down there in the afternoon, and for our pleasures, we'd go through the garbage tip and find ourselves a couple of good mattresses, a couple of good old Kapok mattresses, take them down to Undercliff Bridge and sail them along Cook's River until they sank. But the great thing was that we actually didn't know that we couldn't swim. Our big aim in life was to get them under the stink pipes, which, you know, the pipes that run across Cook's River, we used to call them the stink pipes. Well, we never made Tempe. We actually never got to Tempe. But Gary, who, my God bless him, he's my very old friend, who I saw yesterday, And he said to me, Graham, live every minute of your life and live it as hard and as with as much love as you possibly can. And I said my farewells to him yesterday, and I don't know how much longer he'll be with us.
That's very sad, Graham. I'm horrible. Sorry to hear about it.
It is horrible. I've known him for 72 years. I met him in 516 Illawarra Road, 3 years old, and I had a tricycle, a little red tricycle. And Gary was playing on the footpath, and he didn't get out of my way, so I ran straight over the top of him, and we became blood brothers. All my music influences in those days were, well, obviously, Presley was the one. Johnny O'Keefe, well, you know, I sort of liked him, but he was a bit, he sort of didn't look like a pop star, Johnny. My hero of all heroes was a one-hit wonder called Crash Craddock, and he had a song called Boom Boom Baby. And I'd seen the pop clip, and I went straight out, and I got my mother to knit me a jumper just like Crash Craddock, which had a roll neck collar, it was cream, and it had a red stripe around it and a gold chain across it. And for whatever reason, I was a 12 or 14-year-old Crash Craddock. What was very interesting was that ethnic music was very popular then. Like, you had a lot Italian songs on the hit parade, like Volare, Volare, oh, e cantare. So we could all speak sort of minimal amounts of Italian, you know, just enough. And then, of course, I liked all the comedy sort of stuff, like Purple People Eater. I saw the thing coming out of the sky, had one big horn and one big eye. Said, Mr. Purple People Eater, don't eat me. I can still remember it, you know. My mind is going slowly, but I can remember that vividly. Then I looked at TV. I introduced colour television, but I didn't introduce real television, and that was, what was it, 59 with Ginzel, wasn't it? I can remember, we didn't have a television. The woman next door, they were very wealthy. They were used car salesmen. I used to jump the fence and go in and watch the Mickey Mouse Club, American stuff, Steve Allen show, which was a fantastic, he was a great jazz keyboard player. He had a lot of great comedians on his show. Australian shows that I remember back there, 59, 60, there was an Adelaide show, The Tonight Show, came out of Adelaide, and it was a little, funny little guy with a curly top. People out there might remember, his name was something Walsh, George Walsh or Dave Walsh or whatever, but he was pretty funny. Later on, I liked My Name's Magooly, except it was, you know, Gordon Chater pretending to be an Australian.
What's it like to have been part of creating some of our most cherished jewels of Australian television history?
Well, you know, you had to be there at the time, because people say, you know, what was it like when Auntie Jack, you know, took off? It took years before it actually got the sort of accolades, that, whether I deserved it or not, because at the time, I just made a television show. I was a kid straight out of architecture, and I had no idea, you know, what was happening in my life. I decided I enjoyed entertainment and I enjoyed making people laugh.
So, Graham Bond, do you value your social connections at this stage of your life?
Well, yes. Yeah, I'll tell you what, well, as I said, and I'm losing my nearest and dearest, and I walked away, and that's pretty traumatic, and that's, you know, I don't know where he stands right now. But I had to say farewell yesterday, and because I had to come back to Sydney. My best friend for 72 years, but it'll be a great. You know, we loved one another. We were great close. We were blood brothers, as I said. Through you know, my many occupations, you know, I've picked up friends. I don't have a lot of friends from school. As I said, Gary comes before school. My friends spread wide now. People that, you know, I met through the Auntie Jack show. People I met through television. My producers. People like Jeffrey Atherton, who wrote Mother and Son and also wrote for the Auntie Jack Show and did architecture with me. They're spread wide. Canberra, Melbourne, Byron, and that happens as, you know, as you get older. And they're around my age. My other network is architecture. I'm still pretty close with a whole network of people through architecture who did the reviews. Those people are all very important in my life, and I still keep in touch with them. And of course, they are a network on a network. So, as I said, from my childhood, from architecture, from theatre and television, the ABC, they still have that sort of network of people that are still there.
On behalf of everybody who's listening, I want to thank you for everything that you've ever produced. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you today, Graham Bond.
Terrific.
And that was Graham Bond's request for us to play Rory O'Donoghue, and Good Mates from Fatty Finn, a film in 1980 based on a comic strip, an Australian comic strip that began in 1923. Now for a section that we call Out and About, I spoke recently at Seniors Festival with June Stoddart. Good morning. Now I'm speaking with Jude Stoddart, who is the Joint Senior of the Year for the Inner West Council. The recognition is for your work with the Asylum Seeker Centre. Tell us a little bit about the Asylum Seeker Centre at Newtown.
The Asylum Seeker Centre is a voluntary organisation supported entirely by voluntary effort. I think there's very little, any form of government grant at all. And it seeks to try and help people seeking asylum sort of get their bearings in Australia or in Sydney in particular. They run a service that helps people look at, you know, what their finances are, where they're living, how they can find work, look after their health needs. It tries to provide a whole service that supports people, because when they come, most people have absolutely nothing. They have very few possessions and they've lost so much of their lives. And it's a place where they can come and hopefully feel safe and get some very practical assistance.
You are yourself older, as Sam Iskander, who just announced to everybody that he's 67. And it turns out that just because you're older doesn't mean you can't have fun.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I don't know about everybody else, but I've led a good life and I continue to enjoy it. And actually, I'm fortunate enough to be, although the age I am, I'm fortunate enough to be pretty reasonably fit, but I do try and have to keep fit. It doesn't come naturally. I have to work at it. And I think that's important because I want to stay doing things for as long as I can, because I've been interested in everything in the world in my